You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Dead Sea Scrolls are unarguably one of the greatest historical and religious archaeological discoveries, the oldest copies of Old Testament books ever found. They were hidden away in caves for millennia, but you can actually see them for yourself now at Discovery Times Square, along with other artifacts from the Qumran area, as part of an exhibit called Dead Sea Scrolls, Life and Faith in Biblical Times. And joining us is one of its curators, Risa Levitt Cohn, a professor of the Hebrew Bible and Judaism at San Diego State University. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
This is the kind of exhibit I'd expect to see at the American Museum of Natural History or the Metropolitan Museum of Art. How did it wind up in Discovery Times Square?
Well, you know, it's an incredibly large exhibition. We have over 500 objects on display, and surprisingly enough, there are actually very few museums in town that have that kind of space to devote to a traveling exhibition. So this venue is actually perfect for that.
The exhibit starts with a passage from Genesis written on the walls in Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, and English, and it finishes with another one. Can you tell us about the verses that you picked?
Well, you know, we wanted to start the story with the beginning of the history of Israel, and it seemed that Abraham's command in the Bible in Genesis chapter 11, telling him to go to Israel, was a great place to start. And then we end with a very poignant passage about, you know, sort of peace among the nations, really, which is kind of a nice parting thought for people, we thought.
Seeing the Greek surprised me, but where does Greek fit into this?
Well, you know, the scrolls were mostly copied and composed in what's known as the Second Temple period, so roughly from about 250 BC all the way up to about 68 CE. And the language, the sort of the international language of the time, was actually Greek. And so it's not actually surprising at all that some of the scrolls were written in the language that most people were speaking.
So it's in Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. And did people also speak Hebrew and Aramaic at the time?
Definitely they were speaking Aramaic. We're not really sure whether Hebrew at this time was still a spoken language or if it was a language that was really reserved for sort of prayer and study.
One of the things that is consistent in all the different languages is the way the name of God is written, a very distinctive script that's different from Greek, Aramaic, or Hebrew. Why is that?
Well, I think the thinking is that when a scribe sat down and copied a biblical text or a text that had the name of God in it, when they came across those four consonants, or the tetragrammaton as it's known in the business, that, you know, those were sort of the holiest words that a scribe could copy. And so in some of the scrolls, they use this ancient form of Hebrew called Paleo-Hebrew, perhaps because the scribes thought, you know, this was sort of the closest to the source that they could get.
So is that where we get the name Yahweh from?
That's right.
Because it's four consonants that would suggest that pronunciation.
Right. So in Hebrew, it's four letters. It's literally a Y-H-W-H.
Yud-Heh.
Right. The vowels are added. So Hebrew is an alphabet of consonants, but the vowels are added.
Now, the scrolls were found near the town of Qumran. Were they written there? Do we know?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. You know, there were no scrolls found on the site of Qumran itself, which is a very ancient site. The scrolls were found in 11 caves surrounding the site. And so there are several theories out there. One of them connects the scrolls very integrally to the site of Qumran. Others think they may have come from elsewhere, from Jerusalem or other places around the country.
From people who brought them when they were in hiding?
Sure, or, you know, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in 70 CE, so perhaps people were running from the Romans.
Now, would most people at the time have been able to read them? How common was literacy?
Well, you know, we really don't know. We don't have any hard and fast numbers. But what we do know is that most people read by really having something spoken to them. So there would have been, you know, a narrator, if you will, reading text and a large audience listening. And that was sort of akin to the reading that we think about today.
Where is Qumran? I mean, obviously it's near the Dead Sea, but...
Right.
It's
on the northern shore of the Dead Sea in what today is known as the West Bank.
Mm-hmm. So that's led to a debate over who really should have control of these scrolls?
Well, the scrolls right now
was once part of Jordan.
The scrolls right now are the majority of scrolls are in Israel and are part of the Israel Antiquities Authority collection. There are about 7 or 8 scrolls in Jordan in the National Museum in Amman, and then there are of course scrolls in the hands of public and private dealers all over the world.
At one point, they were available for sale to anyone who thought that they were worth buying?
Well, you know, I guess the most famous is at one point, June 1st, 1954, there was an ad for sale in the Wall Street Journal. And those were the first 4 scrolls that were discovered.
Now, they were discovered by an illiterate shepherd or something like that.
Initially, yes.
And not thought of as being all that important for a while?
Well, I'm pretty sure that the people who initially discovered them had no idea what they were and certainly what their value was, and they turned the scrolls over to somebody who they thought might understand leather, because of course they were written on parchment. And so they turned them over to a cobbler who was quite an enterprising young guy, and he recognized that these could potentially be valuable, and that sort of begins the story of understanding what these things are all about.
But how long before archaeologists and scholars realize that something incredible had
been
discovered?
Probably a couple of years. So, you know, we think the initial find was made sometime around 1947, and I would say probably by 1950, 51, 52, people knew what was going on.
They had to be pieced together. So are most of them readable these days?
Most of the work putting the pieces back together has been done, at least as far as everything that can be placed back together. I'm sure there's a big box of unidentified fragments.
This is kind of like putting together a jigsaw puzzle.
Exactly, without any box tops, though. Yeah. And most of that work has been done. And in fact, if you go to the exhibition, you can see the fragments that have been pieced together to put together, you know, a complete text of a biblical passage or something like that. So yes, that work is complete.
The community rule scroll is quite distinctive. Were the rules specific to the Qumran area?
Well, the rules seem to speak to a specific community, and the community itself is somewhat mysterious because they're not specifically named in the text other than them calling themselves the community. So there may have been one community, there may have been several, but certainly the rules of the rights of entry and how you kept yourself in the group are all very clearly spelled out in that scroll.
Well, it would suggest that there were many variants of religious practice at the time.
Sure, sure. And that's something that we really didn't know before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that there could have been so many different forms of Judaism at this particular point in time.
Nowadays, there isn't as much variation in the practice of Judaism. When did those things change?
I actually think there's a tremendous amount of variation in the practice of Judaism today. So I don't think things have changed much at all. You know, there have always been many ways to come at this central ideas around Judaism.
But there are some basic things that everybody who practices the religion
believes in. Sure, and I
think
there would have been back then, too. So, you know, I think the variation we see in the ancient past is not all that different than the variation we see today, which I think really brings home the idea that people haven't changed that much when it comes to that sort of thinking.
My guest is Risa Levitt-Cohen. We're talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are now on display at Discovery Times Square. Some of the scrolls refer to a son of God as well as to a resurrection of the dead. Those are Christian ideas, aren't they?
Well, that's really the amazing thing about the period in which the scrolls were written and copied, that this is really a point at which Judaism and Christianity are just beginning to take form. And so what we see in the scrolls is really sort of a big soup of theological ideas, some of which eventually make their way into Judaism, some of which make their way into Christianity, and then, of course, they go their separate ways.
Of course, Christians just saw themselves as Jews who believed in something that some of the others in their community didn't believe in. So this could have been, at least some of these people could have been members of a proto-Christian group?
It's certainly possible, but, you know, again, the latest scrolls we have date to about 68 CE. So really this is just the beginning of what becomes the Jesus movement and also the beginning of rabbinic Judaism. So it's a very, very early point in time where I think it would be very hard to differentiate one from the other.
The scrolls aren't the only artifacts in the exhibit. There are jars, coins, even fragments of rope. What can they tell us about how the people of ancient Israel lived?
Well, we really tried to assemble an interesting and varied array of objects. We have actually over 500 objects on display. And our thinking is that the more you can see of what was used in daily life 2,000 and 3,000 years ago, the better a snapshot you get of what life was actually like.
There were also some pieces of cloth that were found in Masada. Is that unusual? Fabric kind of disintegrates, doesn't it? Is this just normal cotton of the sort that we would see today?
It is, actually. And, you know, that's the amazing thing both about the scrolls and all of the organic material that survives. It's because of this unique climatic situation in and around the Dead Sea, because the humidity is so low and because these objects were protected, they really managed to survive in a way that most of this type of material wouldn't.
There are also some shekel weights. What's the significance of those?
Well, that's really the precursor to money in a way, you know, that people would weigh out goods based on certain sort of standard weights. And this was before there was any kind of currency. This would be the best way to trade your goods.
The ossuary stone caskets for bones on a display have stirred up some controversy. Can you tell us about that?
Well, among the ossuaries we have on display are four ossuaries with very interesting names inscribed on them. They were all discovered in the same tomb just outside of Jerusalem in a suburb called Talpiot. And the names that we found on the ossuaries include Jesus, Joseph, and Mary, which, of course, you know, sets up red flags in all kinds of different ways. The truth is that these names were incredibly common in the period of the Second Temple.
Those are not Hebrew names. What would the Hebrew
names they be? Actually, they're Hebrew Aramaic names.
Mary?
Well, I'm giving you the anglicized version, right? But the truth is those names were incredibly common. And so as tempting as it is to see something in this particular tomb related to Jesus, it's highly unlikely.
Aren't the scrolls on display rotated to avoid light damage?
That's right. So at around the 90-day mark of the exhibition, we will have a complete change out of material. So the 10 scrolls that are currently on display will go back to Israel, and we'll bring in 10 new pieces for the duration of the exhibition.
Have you put the 10 together to make some kind of point, or do they just cover a wide range?
Well, we wanted really to give a snapshot of the library and show just how deep and eclectic it was. So there are some biblical texts on display. There's a piece of the community rule. There's a piece of the war scroll. There are commentary texts. So we wanted to vary languages. You'll see, you know, Aramaic, Greek, and Hebrew together. So although they're just 10, you know, we wanted really to give the best and widest view of the library.
If somebody goes back regularly, how many will they wind up seeing before the exhibit closes on April 15th?
21. If you really wanted to do it that way, you could see 21.
Soon to be on display, it's not there yet, is a scroll of the Ten Commandments.
Actually, we just opened this morning, so it's there.
Is that the only copy we have of it?
There are two ancient copies of the Ten Commandments. One is currently in Cambridge and was discovered in Egypt, and this one is part of the Dead Sea Scrolls Library. It's the oldest surviving parchment copy, and it's the oldest complete copy of the Ten Commandments.
And is it pretty much the same text that we know today?
Absolutely.
There's also a section about Masada in the exhibit that's famous as a holdout against the Romans that ended with all of its inhabitants committing suicide. Is that right?
Well, that's what the famous first century historian Josephus says. I think the archaeologists are still, the cards are out on that in terms of how the archaeologists see it.
But it's become a kind of a national symbol for Israel.
Sure, absolutely.
The historical information in the exhibit is extremely detailed. How much would a small settlement like Qumran have been affected by the various conquerors of ancient Israel?
Well, you know, all of the country was very vulnerable because, you know, Israel's a very, very small place and would have been in ancient times, too. And it's literally always been sandwiched between the superpowers of the region, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Greece, and Rome. So the entire country was vulnerable, and Qumran would be no exception.
And would it have been part of the Kingdom of Judah in the years after King Solomon ruled?
Well, we only know of Qumran really from about 200 BCE, so not quite as early as Solomon.
The language used throughout the exhibit is very inclusive. Was it difficult to be accurate with the information while using terms that wouldn't give offense to anyone? Because you have to be very diplomatic when you're talking about these sorts of things, don't you?
Well, you know, we come at this exhibition really as historians, and I think historians as a rule are trained to be very inclusive in their language and to approach subject matter from a very objective perspective, and that's exactly what you'll see in the exhibition.
You've also included a lot of multimedia elements.
Correct.
Because just going in and seeing these 10 scrolls and some of these other artifacts probably wouldn't make much sense unless we received all that other information, including big chunks of history.
Well, we really wanted to transport people as best we could from Times Square to ancient Israel. And it's hard to do that just with pots and jars. So we, you know, made use of great visuals and movies and all kinds of other things to try to contribute to that trip.
This exhibit also reveals that we've changed our ideas about, archaeologists have, about preservation and the sorts of techniques that are required to work with something like the Dead Sea Scrolls. What were they doing when they first got an opportunity to put them together?
Well, the group of scholars who first were tasked with this immense job of, you know, putting these thousands and thousands of fragments back together, you know, would lay them out on these long tables and almost like a jigsaw puzzle without any box tops to guide them, try to piece things back together. And whenever they got a group of pieces that looked like they'd match, they'd take what was at the time, you know, cutting-edge technology, Scotch tape, and tape the fragments to a piece of glass and then put another plate of glass on top of it.
But wouldn't the Scotch tape damage the scrolls?
Of course, and it did. And, you know, I'm sure they didn't, you know, sort of, hindsight is 20/20, right? But they didn't really think about it back then. And, of course, now the Antiquities Authority in Israel is working very hard to remove all of the residue of the tape and to sort of save the scrolls from the fate that they suffered in the 50s.
But how do you put them together now?
Well, most of the pieces are put together, and so really the job right now is cleaning them. Mm-hmm. So removing them from the glass plates, getting the residue of the tape off of them, and conserving them in a way that's much, much more protective and much less damaging.
Are all the people working on the scrolls from the Israeli Antiquities Authority?
Right. There are four full-time conservators who work on the scrolls at any given time.
And then for those of us who want to see more, they're being scanned and made available online, aren't they?
That's correct.
So when will we have pretty much everything available to us?
Well, you know, it's a huge library, so I would imagine it's going to take quite a long time to get it all up and going.
And what happens finally to the scrolls? Where will they be stored?
Well, they go back to Israel, and, you know, the best situation for the scrolls, honestly, is to be kept in the dark. And so that's where they'll go after the exhibition.
So when the exhibit closes on April 15th, that's it?
Well, these scrolls will go back to Israel.
But will the exhibit travel to other places?
The exhibit actually is traveling next to the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, and it'll open in May.
Well, thank you so much for being with us to talk about it. Risa Levitt-Cohn is a professor of the Hebrew Bible and Judaism at the San Diego State University and one of the people responsible for this exhibit called Dead Sea Scrolls, Life and Faith in Biblical Times at Discovery Times Square. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having me.